Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we ask your blessing upon this prophet study section. We trust you, God, and ask you to open our eyes and hearts and ears to you. We learn what you've done, why you did it, and that we may mimic you and mimic what you desire. We trust you, God, and ask you to continue to guide us in our lives. In the name of your Son, we pray. Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen.
2 Samuel chapter 6. David again brought together out of Israel chosen men, 30,000 in all. He and all his men set out from Baalah of Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim that are on the Ark. They set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Iho, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the Ark of God on it. And Ahio was walking in front of it. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord with songs and with harps, lyres, tambourines, sistrums, and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the Ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore God struck him down, and he died there beside the Ark of God. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah, and to this day that place is called Perez Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How can the Ark of the Lord ever come to me?" He was not willing to take the Ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Instead, he took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. The Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months, and the Lord blessed him and his entire household. Excuse me. Now King David was told, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the Ark of God." So David went down and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the Ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. As the Ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. When she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the Ark of the Lord and set it in the place inside the tent that David had pitched for it, and David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women, and all the people went to their homes. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "I was before the Lord, who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death.
I know we already covered and discussed the first half of this chapter 2 weeks ago. That was verses 1 through 11. But before I continue on, verse 12 and onward, were there any questions that came that I didn't answer last time for the first half of this chapter? I realize it's, of course, the death of Uzzah. We discussed why and how and the details of that and what the current circumstances were regarding it. This transportation ark is in much greater detail recorded in 1 Chronicles chapter 15 and 16. This in 2 Samuel gives a basic rundown of what was going on. 1 Chronicles gives great detail regarding who did what, when they did it, why they did it. Everything else you can imagine is written there. This is 1 Chronicles chapter 15 as well as chapter 16. Now, if you recall correctly, Uzzah died because David incorrectly ordered the people to transport the ark contrary to God's will on the method. God does not wish to have animals carrying it. He does not wish to be carried on a cart. It would be carried by people, only by people, only particular people. David knew that. He deliberately did it against God because he didn't care at the time. And he learned the hard way that that was unacceptable in God's eyes. In this particular second half, which is the correct transportation of the ark, as far as how he moves it the way which God commanded it to be moved, obviously, much better outcome. But after the first incident from Uzzah, this was David's response. This is in 1 Chronicles. This is 1 Chronicles chapter 15, starting in verse 2. David said, "No one may carry the ark but the Levites, for the Lord has chosen them to carry the ark and to minister before him forever." David gathered all Israel together at Jerusalem to bring the ark to the place, to the Lord, to its place, which he prepared for it. David assembled the children of Aaron, the Levites, the sons of Kohath, Uriel the chief, 120 of his brethren, the sons of Merari, Azza the chief, 220 of his brethren, the sons of Gershom, Joel the chief, and 130 of his brethren, sons of Elphan, Shemaiah, the chief, 200 of his brethren, and the sons of Hebron, Eliel, the chief, and 80 of his brethren, sons of Uziel, Abinadab, the chief, 112 of his brethren. We'll stop there for a second. Who are all these men? What particular details are about these Levites do we know? He has included every tribe, every family, every tongue, subcategory of a tribe family is in here. I mean, he's got the sons, he's got the grandsons, he's got the great grandsons, all built into these men and all their lineages, all the various lines. Because you know, Aaron had a brother, of course, was Moses, but they are from a family of Kohath. Well, Kohath also had brothers, Gershom and Merari. Those are three sons. All of them had their children. Of course, these are all included. That's three. He only had three. How many are listed here? One, Kohath, Merari, Gershom, Elizaphan, Hebron, and Uzzel. That's six. Who are the other three? They're all Levites. There are six, but there's supposed to be three. Why are there six? No guesses, no recollections? Okay. Back in Exodus, the three main sons, Kohath, Merari, and Gershom, had other children as well. That they were so righteous in their own right that they had their own family lines assigned to them. So, for example, Kohathites, he had, I think it was three or four children. He was three children. Four children? Crud, hold on. I wrote that down. I should look that up. Three children. Hebron was one of his children, Uzzel was one of his children, and Elizaphan was one of his children. He was broken up into three separate categories. So why is he listed here as Kohath? He's listed here as Elizaphan, Hebron, and Uzzel. Well, there's a unique thing that God assigned the priesthood. This is their own right that God chose to do it. Kohath had assignments given to them as far as the transportation of the ark, how you manage and take care of it, the praising process, what animals are sacrificed. Merari had their own rules, what they had to do, certain things that they were allowed to assign and take care of. Well, in Kohath's group, he was broken up into three separate groups of his assignments in the Torah. So, guess what? One of each son took a different task. So that's what David's doing. He is doing his best to obey the Torah to the T. He is not deviating one speck. Why? Because his screw-up cost another more righteous man than him his life. He's been very careful in that. What does that tell you about David? He wanted to please God. He repents well. He learns from his mistakes. We've been told many times, God had said already, chosen a man that's after my own heart. right? That's the whole detail of why God chose David. So what does that tell you about God if this is what David learned? He wants us to learn by our mistakes. Is it okay to make those mistakes? Ultimately. Ideally, we don't want to make mistakes. That's true. But he's going to learn. He's going to teach you through them. Those are acceptable items. It's okay to make mistakes. And is death that terrible of a mistake? Not with God. It is in our eyes. Oh, well, that's it. Well, no, God, it's okay. So when you die, it's okay. I'll use somebody else. And when I'm done, I can raise you back up if I need you. Meanwhile, just sleep. It's not a big deal. Death, we think, is the ultimate. Oh, no, that's the end of it. God, no, it's not. I used you. Thank you for your service. Sleep now. Next person, please. It's just the process which it goes wrong. So in David's case, with Uzzah, which we learned last week, had Uzzah not attempted to save the ark, and the ark had fallen on the ground, what would the resulting consequence have been? The death of David. So Uzzah saved David's life by doing this. Now, would it be okay if God killed David? Well, of course. Would that have gone against all the promises he has given and will give to David? Of course not, because David already had children. The promise of the lineage would have continued on. David, you screwed up. That's okay. Next. One person in the line of many, many people. It would not have been that big of a deal. But due to Uzzah's sacrifice of himself, he saved David's life. So in this case, David did not want to make such a mistake. No one should have to sacrifice themselves on his behalf. Hence, he follows it to the T. He lists every family to the whole process, including, of course, the high priest. I'm going to read all these chapters. There's just certain sections I want to focus on and draw your attention to. He says to them, verse 12, you are the heads of the father's house of the Levites. Sanctify yourselves, you and your brethren, that you may bring up the ark of God of Israel to the place I have prepared for it. For because you did not do it the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us, because we did not consult him about the proper order. The priests and Levites sanctified themselves to bring the ark of the Lord up, the children of Israel up. The children of Levites bore the ark of the covenant on their shoulders by its poles, as Moses had commanded, according to the word of God. David knew his mistake. He acknowledged it. Did he have to go pray and God, please tell me, what did I do wrong? He didn't have to, because David knew the Torah very, very well at this point. He actually had recited it to others at this point. So he knew he did something wrong. He knew exactly what it was the moment that happened. So his first response was, how can I bring this Ark of the Covenant up to me? Look what it has done. Because of my mistake. Only 3 months go by and has all this prepped out and ready to go. He knows the rules. He just didn't obey them the first time. This time he gets to obey. So, every 6 paces, he sacrifices an ox and a fatted ox. And so one is the Ola offering, which is the complete burned up. Nobody gets to eat any of that. The second sacrifice is the one which is Shelemim. Everybody gets, it's a peace offering. Everybody gets to eat a portion of it. So every 6 paces from Obed-Edom's house, front door, all the way to Jerusalem. We don't know exactly where Obed-Edom lives. That's the only difficulty. All we know, he lives somewhere within about 1 mile distance of Jerusalem. How many ox does that take? Every 6 paces, 2 animals. That's a lot. Yes. Yes. I'm supposed to record this. Sorry about that.
Sacrificed on the bronze altar. So, were they carrying this, or they were just sacrificing?
This is David just sacrificing. This is where I wanted to talk about this. As I mentioned, David follows every letter to the T. So how does he get away with this? Why is he not obeying the sacrificing on the altar? David is not a priest. David is not part of the priesthood. He can sacrifice according to the Torah anywhere he chooses because he's not part of the Levitical priesthood. The Lord hadn't named anywhere yet. That's his resting place. Well, once he places his name there and he's physically there, then you're not allowed to. Here's the deal. He's in the middle of transportation. So where is the altar? Also in the middle of transportation. Because they all have to move together. Along with all the boards, which we're learning about and reading about, the whole tabernacle, everything has its own procession or order. Well, the ark is one of the items in this order. He's sacrificing essentially straight in front of the ark. Not like right there, but close enough to it. Where are all these animals going? We're burning one up completely, and the other one we cut up, it's for feeding, for everybody gets to eat. Is he feeding everybody along the way? No. Not he, at the end of it, he feeds them. Sorry. He's accumulating all this. By the time he achieves or reaches Jerusalem, it points out that everybody there, all 30,000 men, get a generous portion of meat. Guess where the meat came from? All the fatted oxen he slaughtered every six paces along the way. Generous portion of bread, wine, various other items they get. So he's accumulating these items, of course, to feed all these people, not for forever, but at least for a day. Bill, you had your hand up a second ago?
I just wonder if this is some foreshadowing
too. It is foreshadowing, which we're going to get that shortly.
Sorry.
No, that's great. I'm glad you pointed it out. We're going to get there. There's a little bit of foreshadowing going on here. I don't have the answers to everything, but I do have a few points I'd like to point out, which we'll get to in a moment. So David goes through this process. What is David dressed in? Linen and an ephod. So I have a question. Most of you probably read this statement and said, what? Because I did it first when I did a double check, because that didn't sound right. When Michael's daughter comes out and says, how is he honored who exposed himself today? Many of you say, oh, well, David danced naked amongst the front of the ark. Did he dance without clothing on? No, he'd break the Torah, he'd be stoned to death because you did it not only in front of God, which God specifically said, you do this, I will kill you. He also done it in front of all the people, which, of course, you're exposing yourself in front of women and children and else. Also, if you do this, it's against the Torah, you are stoned to death. So was David stoned to death? No. Therefore, we can conclude, was he naked? No, he was not naked. So what is she referring to when she says exposed? He's obviously has a linen tunic on. He has an ephod on.
Well,
his kingly robes. There's something very unique about Michal, the lady who's accusing him of this. Anybody recall who she is? Saul's daughter, right? Now, of course, David has multiple wives, and we're not going to discuss all that today. But Saul's daughter, Michal, does she have any children? Not according to this, before or after. She was married before this to David. Saul then remarried her to somebody else because he didn't like David. And David said, bring her back. So now she's back to David again. So she's been around a little while. No offense to her, but she has to obey whatever the king orders, else she dies. Two options you have. And maybe death's not so bad, but that's what she opted to do. So this was her life story. But what household was she then raised in? Saul's household. When David encounters Michal, what does he tell her? No. In this instance, when she accuses him, says, "Were you not honored in front of them?" What was his answer?
He said that God chose him over.
Exactly, and Jonathan and her whole family line. So her accusation, "You are not honored as a king." His response was clearly. I'm assuming this, that if she's accusing him of not being kingly, then she probably was raised that a king should be kingly. That's my assumption. And David's response was, God chose me over your father and your brothers. So your kingly acts that you were desiring to put upon me, God clearly doesn't value. The kingly, the honor, the dignifiedness of it. David wasn't dignified to start with. As a young boy, through his killing sprees and various other things he did, there was no dignity involved. It was a matter of just doing. So David's act of just doing, that's who he is. What does it tell you about the heart of God? Spontaneous? Not quite spontaneous, because there are rules. David did spontaneous by trying to move the ark at his own method. That was spontaneous.
God
said he looked upon the heart of David. Now the word to get carried away is galah,
yes,
which is the root of galu, which means to be exiled or to be carried away. In other words, his heart was just so thrilled that God had forgiven him, and he was putting it all right as best as he knew how to the extent of the Torah. He just was literally got carried away with dancing, twirling, jumping up and down. People thought he was making a fool of himself, that David was beyond being embarrassed. He was so carried away.
Very well put. Beyond being embarrassed is a great way of wording it. You have a man whose heart is so intense and so oblivious to what's going on about him that his whole being and everything is focused solely upon worshiping and praising God.
He doesn't
care what it looks like, doesn't care what it think, ignores it all, but he doesn't break the rules. He ignores what people think, not what God thinks. Now, contrast that to Saul. Recall what his Achilles heel was? He focused everything about what people thought and cared very little about what God thought. Pride. How you appear. How you look. This is how it should be. What do the people want? Oh, okay. It's okay. Yes, God told me to do that, but it's all right. I'll do what everybody else wants. When God confronts him or Samuel confronts him, oh, well, I was just doing what the people wanted, so it's their fault. It's always make yourself look good. The exact opposite of who David wants. So what does God want? He wants us to be completely true and honest and focus upon him. Who cares what anybody else says, thinks, or does about you? Your past means nothing. Your future actually means nothing. Your current and present is what matters in God's eyes, because that's what you're doing. That's what he wants you to focus upon. Hank, you had your hand up. Sorry about that. I ignored you a minute ago.
God's done with Jesus, Yeshua, everything. It's never about vanity or looks. Quite the opposite. In fact, he does things very humbly and simply to see if we will recognize the truth of that.
You're absolutely right. One person put it, I forgot who it was, forgive me if I've insulted you, it is truly to be a chosen person. When God says, all right, it should be from person A to person B, but I'm choosing instead of person B over here, this person over here. That is to be chosen. And all throughout Israel's history is to be chosen. And that becomes a certain responsibility. Everything follows, and you must be chosen to be like God and to honor him and worship in that fashion. It is a change of your heart, change of your desire, change of your being. So always follow that. And
David has
heart like after God's own heart. That's what he's supposed to do. He got punished. You mean his response? We discussed that last time. We discussed a little more detail, just to reiterate, because it's a good point. It's important to bring this up. Who was David angry with? Himself. See, he wasn't angry with God, though God's the one who killed someone. He was fearful. So, he did not have the reverence. He didn't obey the word of God at that moment. He was disobeying, believing that he was perfectly justified in doing so. He learned from that mistake. God taught him that is not acceptable. Thus, he had to undo his mistake by doing it correctly the second time. Disobedience like that? He hasn't numbered anybody yet. That's later. He hasn't numbered anybody yet. Now, David goes through a series of tests. He's passed most of them. This one, so far, he failed temporarily, but then he passed it later on. He goes the same sequence, actually, many, many times in his life. of the test the Messiah had to go through. What were the three tests Messiah did live through? What were the three sins, the three main sins categories? Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life. Right? Messiah had to test them all. Messiah passed all three. The first time. Does David pass all of his tests? No, he doesn't. What does that tell you about David? He's human. He's still a human being, so he's going to make mistakes. We're not arguing that David's a perfect person. He's not. He's a Messiah-like, in that his lifestyle, and we're supposed to learn from him and say, okay, if David did these few things correctly, our Messiah must also be doing these few same things correctly. That's how we identify who the Messiah is. Else we could have lived 2,000 years ago and not have recognized the Messiah wandering the countryside. We wouldn't have known. I don't know, some guy's over there, some guy's over here. Who do you believe? Doesn't matter. Go back to work. We have these stories written down, and this sequence is written down, which we're going to get into great detail in a few chapters from now. I'm going to teach you a lot about English literature. Not that I know a whole lot about it, but it's something I did learn. That we're supposed to learn by observation and parallel. If David does a sequence of events, there's an extremely high probability the Messiah is going to do the same sequence of events. He'll do them correctly, but still do them. When David flees Absalom, he is mimicking the Messiah fleeing the priesthood, fleeing the Sanhedrin. Where he goes, when he goes there, what he does, it's a match. They parallel each other all the way through. And then in David's case, he does the exact reverse then after he's done. He goes all the way back, reverses all the way back to where he started, back to kingship again. It's a literary technique which is going to teach you how to observe and spot when the Bible is talking about the Messiah. More than just looking at, oh, well, hey, here we discuss this. Here's the number three, there's a life and death situation, clearly there's a Messiah issue going on here. We know those. Tony Robbins did an excellent job explaining that to us. But there's more than that. Messiah, God doesn't always use the number three to tell you something about him. Because number three doesn't tell you what the Messiah does in his lifetime. If I just tell you, okay, the Messiah is risen, dies and is risen in 3 days. That's great. That's the only thing you'll look for. Then when you find somebody who's risen in 3 days, okay, great. What did he teach back when he was alive? Let's go back and find out. Then you missed the boat, didn't you? On the other hand, if you say, oh, hey, there's this Joe Schmuck over here who's doing all these various things. I want to learn more about him while he's still alive. I'm going to follow and be taught while he's still here. While I can still ask him questions. I can get more details, more expounding than what I wouldn't have gotten by second-hand information or third-hand or tenth-hand. Those details are what God desired for everybody when the Messiah showed up. Them to recognize when he was around. So he wrote this stuff down in 2 Samuel in particular, because it's so blatantly obvious about it, so that when the people did receive the Messiah, when they did show up, they would see him while he was still alive, recognize it, and then follow it. So David is a Messiah-like figure. Not that he's perfect, not that he doesn't make mistakes, but he goes through the life cycle the Messiah does. Yes, Hank.
There's the 1, 2, 3, but then there's Elijah and Elisha. You know, John the Baptist helped prepare the way for people to see 1, 2, and 3 come about.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. There were a number of issues. A number of signals. When John the Baptist showed up, of course, says, hey, beware, somebody's coming. Hey, this is it, this is the guy. We're supposed to pay attention to that as well. That was a little more obvious about it. What I find very, very fascinating about David is that because he's a man after God's own heart, is that he desired to follow God at all costs. He was not successful all the time, but he still desired it. That's honorable. That's desirable. But that means that's who Messiah is. To follow God after his own heart. Because Messiah has the heart of God. So this is the type of person I would desire to be if I was. If I could be that's the goal. I can't ask Messiah a whole lot of questions and get like straight verbal answers. Some of you might speak to him that way, I don't. He doesn't talk back to me in the same fashion. But I can read a lot more about him, but also about David, and get some of those questions answered. Some of those details answered. Because some of the stuff that's written for us to learn about the Messiah is written here in David's life as well. Read them both to get a greater picture of who this man was, what he ticked, what made him tick.
So is there a parallel with him bringing the ark to Jerusalem and the sacrificing every six paces? I mean,
there is some. We're talking about this. Well, might as well talk about it right now. Okay. What do we know about this Messiah? What is he supposed to do still? Our Messiah, what is he supposed to still do? He hasn't done yet. Say a little louder. Bring the 12 tribes together. That's one of the things. What else is he supposed to do? He has to return, roar against Israel's enemies, which we're reverting in chapter 7 of this book, this chapter, next chapter, which we'll discuss about the Messiah battling Israel's enemies. The kingdom to his father, return the kingdom to his father. What is something that, I don't have a good way of wording this, so bear with me. When you're up here dancing or singing, what are you doing? Worshipping and praising God, right? Does God accept and expect worship and praise in that fashion only? What other fashion is worshipping and praising God? Prayer, that's one.
I think being in service to others is a way of praising God. Jumping out of your own skin and taking care of this person.
That's a fair way of wording it.
That's what Christ did.
That's true, it is what he did. He did take care of others over himself.
Example, how can you fail?
That seems reasonable. Those of you who recall, not to refresh all your memories, but some of them, the sacrifices recorded in Leviticus, are those praise sacrifices? Not all, but some of them are, aren't they? Some of them are. Which ones? Do you recall? Shilamim, yes, the peace offering. A holah offering is too. Sin offering, guilt or not, the others are. What is the distinction between the two? The Shilamim and the Olaf. What's the distinction between those two?
One is worship of God.
One's worship.
Admitting your false.
No, neither of these two are false. Neither of these two are not for sin. Olaf offering is not for sin, and Shilamim offering is not for sin. They do. What do they do? What's the difference between the two of them? Okay, the Olah offering is a praise offering. What's its purpose? It is a completely free will offering, but it's recorded in Leviticus chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, I think it's from 5 as well. It's a purpose for celebration, honoring God, worshiping God, saying thank you. And what do you get out of it? Absolutely nothing. You receive nothing from it. You don't do it for forgive me of my sins. You don't do it for please bless me more. You don't do it for thank you what you've already done for me. It's God, I love you. I'm offering this up. I'll see you next week. Essentially, that's the principle behind it. The Shilamim offering, the peace offering, what's that one? That's like we consider like almost like a barbecue. Everybody gets to enjoy that. Hey, like invite your friends, invite your family. So when David is offering these two sacrifices, what's he doing and demonstrating that the Messiah is to do? What's the parallel? The same thing the Messiah is still supposed to do. Messiah is still supposed to prepare the way for God to come, is he not? How is he supposed to do that? Well, Revelation records it. Zechariah records bits and parts of it. Daniel records a few small smidgens, but it's kind of borderline there. He records the sequences of events. The sequences of offerings. Offerings of what? What gets offered? No. What gets offered when the Messiah prepares the way for the God to come? God to come.
He offers the world that he was over Father now.
At the end of Sukkot, when God is supposed to come down, when God's supposed to come down back to earth again, you know, that the thousand-year reign is over. He now has this wonderful kit and caboodle called the Kingdom of God. He says, here, Dad, it's yours. What does that gain him? It gains Messiah absolutely nothing. It's a complete gift. He says, God, I love you. Thanks. That's an Ola offering. What's a Shelemim offering that he does also for God? The peace offering. What is Messiah actually supposed to offer? He already offered himself. By the way, that was also an Ola offering. Ola offering for himself. Everybody else gained something out of it. But he didn't. What's the peace offering he's supposed to give? The same one that David's giving here. We discussed the Ola offering. Here's the kingdom, God. David disrobed for that. I'll be a high priest, essentially. You can take the kingdom away. It's yours. David's giving us that symbol. What peace offering? What's the peace offering he's giving to us? What's Messiah supposed to offer as a peace offering? Now, who benefits from the peace offering? Yes, sorry, Nathaniel. Say it again. Say it again. A little louder.
He gives us rest.
Rest. Oh, well, he does give a rest. But who does it? Who gets the rest? We do. So, what's David offering as peace offerings?
All of us.
You got it. All of us. We are the peace. We're the ones who receive the peace offering. Because in Messiah's time, when he says, okay, God, thank you, here is your kingdom. Done. All your people who are in your kingdom, here is the blessing of peace upon them. Here is the blessing, it's a peace offering. The blessing of food upon you. This is the gift I give to your kingdom people, the dwelling, those who dwell in it. He blesses God by giving you a wonderful offering of Ola, a complete gift. It says, here's everybody, here's all for you. So what's David symbolically doing? He is doing that when he is moving and saying, God, this way, come this way, here's a kingdom. Everybody, have peace, have praise, praise, worship, love, praise God. Next six paces, God, here's the portion of your kingdom. Everybody, here's your peace being poured upon you. He's symbolically doing it. That's the parallel between the two. Is there more? Yes, there is. Do I have time to talk about all of it? No, because I don't know all of it. I know some bits and parts. But there's sequences of events that occur here that we're supposed to be recognizing. So the Messiah, his job is both king and priest. David is symbolically doing. Saying, all right, as kingly role, I'm supposed to be this king person. But as priestly role, I'm supposed to serve the people. David is symbolically saying, all right, God, here is my kingdom, is yours. And all the people recognize this is God's kingdom. You are going to be given to this ark that's traveling. It's a very, very graceful, very beautiful image of what David is doing. Now, Michael ruins it. So you weren't kingly-like. What does that tell us about our Messiah? Will this be a kingly-like event? No, it won't. Will he look like a king? Why not? Because God's supposed to be the king. He disrobes. David disrobes. Messiah disrobes. Says, I am not king right now. It's God. These images are written for us. These stories are written for us to observe and learn from. That we can say, hey, I can recognize when this stuff happens. Write it down. Make a note. Is this the only time David does this type of thing? No, David symbolizes the Messiah many times in his life. It's the only time he disrobes. But that's about it. The objective is for us to learn from and observe and watch so we recognize when things happen. I'm a firm believer, granted you may call me crazy, that whatever somebody does in the Torah, in the Bible, when they are foreshadowing a future person, God's writing down their actions. And when he writes down and says, okay, for example, pretend I'm God. So we, okay, David, now what's the Messiah supposed to do? Oh, okay. Now what do you want him to do? Okay. Now what do you want him to do? Okay, I'll write that down too. That God is recording these men just as much as they're being orchestrated by him. Personal belief. You call me crazy, I don't really care. That's just my personal belief. Because I see so much oddities. Like, oh, that's a personality trait of this person. Oh, look what they did. Oh, look, it matches so-and-so over here. Why on earth would God match a personality characteristic trait over to this guy over here? Because that person was who they were. And he liked them. I find that interesting. Kind of remarkable as well. God records a lot of things about Elijah and Elisha. Some of them, my opinion, were personality quirks. And God recorded it anyway. And in one case, he uses it again. Which we'll get there when we discuss Kings, which we're not in Kings right now. We're still in 2 Samuel. I'm actually finishing almost on time. Any questions or comments? There's more to this, but unfortunately I'm giving you only taste because the next sections span multiple chapters, not just little small segments like this. Like, for example, chapter 6 is all condensed in a single chapter. The next sequences that David starts mimicking the Messiah are going to span 5, 6, 10 chapters at a time. And it's a little more difficult to discuss that in a single hour. So bear with me on that as I go through this process. It's not an easy thing to teach. God willing, he'll give you ears to hear and my mouth to make sense, and we'll all get something out of it. But one thing that's I find fascinating is the sequence which God teaches when he doesn't use a symbol. It's the way he directs someone to live. I am learning that currently. We all know symbols. We know what Shabbat, oh, it's symbolic of, it's rest, it's a holy day, all the holy days seem to tie into it. We know it's a symbol. It's a time, but it's also a symbol. We know menorah, oh yes, the eyes of God, the seven angels. We know the symbol. That's great. But if I take one right footstep and then another one, what on earth is that a symbol of? Nothing. Because God doesn't always have to use a symbol to teach something. He uses sequences of events, the actions of a person. A person does this, and then does this, and then does this. Okay. And then the person says, okay, I'm going to go back and do this one, and then go back and do the original one again. When God does that, and by the way, he does it many, many, many times throughout the Old Testament. I mean, you'll be surprised how many times he does this. He does the sequence, and then goes back again, and what's the objective when he does that? By the way, this section here in chapter 6 is the start of one of those sequences, but I'm focusing on it. His objective is you to focus on the point which the turnaround point occurred. The moment which the character said, okay, stop, now go back. That stopping point is what God's trying to draw your attention to. We'll discuss in a great detail what that means and give you a number of examples to them. One in particular, a lot about Hasatan, the devil, what he does and how he shows himself up periodically throughout David's life. How many times did you know that David talked to the devil? Did he ever record him talking to the devil? No, he never recorded talking to the devil. But God says he does. Many, many times. Sometimes this person's a devil and sometimes they're not. Because how many times did the Messiah have to deal with him? So if the Messiah had to face the devil in the form of Judas Iscariot, in the form of the actual temptations themselves, guess what? David sure as heck had to face the same person. How else would we have known that Judas Iscariot is supposed to be around? Did anybody know that Messiah had to have a Judas Iscariot? Well, he had to have one because God set it up that way. So how do we know? Because David has one too. A number of them, actually. We all do. You're right, we all do in some ways. But we learn by these. We learn by these sequences of events. And this is nothing more than one of them. It's the beginning of one, which will span into the next chapter as well. Yes, Ellie. The one would go bad. He knew one would go bad because the one of David's had to go bad. Sorry, Bill, you had your hand up. Right. Right. It's God's throne. Right. Now, right, and when we're expecting Messiah to come and take the kingdom or establish a kingdom, is it his kingdom he's establishing?
Fuzzy.
It gets fuzzy.
He accepts worship.
Exactly. So in David's case, when he disrobes, is he still king? Yes and no. He's disrobing and temporarily becoming a priest. He's no longer accepting the robe, the king robes. He's not a king temporarily. And when the guard comes and establishes itself in Jerusalem, and David eventually flees Absalom, David is no longer king anymore. Absalom's king. And then God's king again, temporarily. And the point is, the lines are getting fuzzier. And David is actually helping us to see that. Helping us to see something less clearly.
the kenosis.
What was that again?
I don't think it's to see more clearly
the
so-called kenosis.
I'm sure that term, kenosis.
It's basically, I know what it means, though.
The definition of it, that's all right.
He's talking by choice set aside.
Himself. Well put. That's exactly what David's doing. By choice, setting aside. Have a wonderful rest of the Shabbat. Thank you for your time, and enjoy.